On December 25th in the year 1932, King George V of Great Britain did something that had never been done before, and he broadcasted a Christmas message to the entire world. And so that day on December 25th, there were engineers who were getting ready to do this thing that at first began as a wild idea, and they set up all that this radio broadcast, all these wires going in and out from this office that George V was going to speak from. And as they're getting ready to sit down, and I have a picture of George sitting at his desk. There he is, about to give the Christmas message. One of the engineers noticed that there were two wires that had become, at some point in the process of setup, disconnected. And so this is moments before he's about to begin, and there's no delaying a moment like this. And so these two wires he sees are disconnected. And funny enough, do you want to know what country would not have heard the Christmas message if those wires would have remained disconnected? America, okay? Now, Gabe, who just did announcements, he would be glad for those wires to be disconnected. In his opinion, why do we need to hear from Great Britain, am I right? But they wanted to make sure that everyone had heard this message. Again, it was the first of its kind. And so the engineer goes to nudge the wire against the disconnected wire and holds this awkward position for the entire broadcast of this Christmas message, which was about 4 to 5 minutes. It wasn't very long, wasn't a very long speech. But if you've ever been in an awkward position, holding an awkward form where you could not move, you know that any length of time feels like an eternity. So that sound engineer is nudging that wire against the disconnected wire so that America and so that the whole world can hear the voice of the King. Now, you may be wondering, Chris, why do you bring this up? Why do you tell us this story? It's interesting, but how does it apply? The goal of my message today is to nudge you in a direction where connection is found so that you can hear the voice of the King. Not this King, but the King of all kings. And we're doing that by continuing in our series on the battle, as you saw from the bumper. And the first week of this series was kind of a general introduction to what this series would hold. But then, for the past 3 weeks, over the past 3 weeks, we've approached three different topics. The first topic was creating your support team. So we talked about building relationships, having people around you as an army to help you to fight these battles. And then after that, we dove into what does it look like when we feel weak in the midst of our battles? Where do we find our strength? And then last week, Pastor Kevin, who this morning is speaking in at our Marion County campus in Buena Vista, spoke on fortifying our minds that if we're going to face the battles we face, God is oftentimes not concerned about changing necessarily the circumstances as far as he is changing our mind. Every single week, we've also introduced to you how these battles are often created using a mathematical formula. And this is that mathematical formula. We first, all of us have a nature that even those for us who find ourselves following Jesus, although we do our best to walk by the Holy Spirit, we have this nature, this flesh that is fighting against the Spirit. And so sometimes we end up doing things that we never wanted to do in the first place. Then we also, though, as human beings have needs. Some of those needs are spoken, they're known, some of them are not. Sometimes they're met, and sometimes they're not. And then we also have pain. Pain that's brought on by choices that we make. Pain that's brought on by circumstances outside of our control. Oftentimes, maybe even a great surprise to us that causes this pain. And all of this is just unavoidable in life. And so we've said each week that what these things create is an emotional disturbance. It creates this battle for us, not just externally, but also internally. And this is what I want to approach today. This is my question for this message, is how do we stay emotionally healthy and spiritually alive in the midst of life's battles? Today we're going to touch on the emotional disturbance part of that equation by answering this question. And what I want to do today is I want to nudge you in the direction of a spiritual practice that will cause us to do three things in our life. It'll cause us to slow down. It'll cause us to pay attention. And it will cause us to connect to God's love. And we'll find that only by doing these things can we remain emotionally healthy and spiritually alive in the midst of life's battles. Of course, this is something that when we look at the life of Jesus, we see that Jesus did this well. And if we're going to follow Jesus, then that also means that we have to do what Jesus did. It's the only way that we become like him is by following his life example, and even the patterns of his life is how we become more like him. And slowing down, paying attention, not minding the interruptions, connecting to his Father's love, we see that Jesus did this well throughout his life. And his human experience is just like yours and mine. He had battles. He faced temptations. He had people who didn't see the value in his life. If you are someone here today who always feels like you're looked over, you're missed, Jesus also had people in his life that didn't see his value, that God was literally in front of them and they completely missed it. In the midst of those battles, we see Jesus was emotionally healthy and spiritually alive. And what I want to do is I want to start today by looking at two emotionally vulnerable moments that Jesus had in his life. And the first can be found in Luke chapter 19. So if you have a Bible, open there. I think it's great to open a Bible, have it in front of you, whether that's on the Bible app or bring a paper copy, take some notes. It'll also be up on the screen. But we're going to go from Luke 19 to Matthew, back to Luke. So we're going to flip several places today. Luke 19, starting in verse 41. That as Jesus approached Jerusalem and saw the city, it says he wept over it. And he said, if you, talking about Jerusalem, even you had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. That the peace, you've missed out on it. I've come and I'm about to leave. Because the Jerusalem, the city that I'm about to enter, is going to be the city of my death. Yes, it's going to be the city of my resurrection. But by that time, you've missed this peace that has come before you. And he says, the days will come upon you, embankment against you, and encircle you and hem you in on every side. And they will dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another. And this is why, because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. Before Luke chapter 19, Jesus and his disciples began their ministry in Galilee, which was this northern part of Israel. And they made their way from town to town to town to town until they arrived outside of Jerusalem, proclaiming this peace, proclaiming that God's kingdom had come. And Jesus gets to Jerusalem and he's overlooking the city. And as we see here, he begins to weep. And in this moment, Jesus doesn't recognize, oh gosh, I'm around my guy friends, I'm around my disciples and some women as well. Let's suck it up and get this over with. He doesn't just wipe off the tears real fast and continue to march towards Jerusalem. But he takes a moment to slow down and to weep and for people to see this, for people to see his heart and for people to see how he felt. And we know that he weeps because, as he says in this last verse, you did not recognize, they did not recognize when God had come to them on earth. They completely missed it. And a self-reflective question I have for you today is, has the battles of life caused you to miss God's presence? I'm going to make it really practical and be vulnerable this morning as well. One battle that I've been facing lately is this battle of busyness. And so I had to ask myself this week, Chris, has the battle of busyness caused you to miss God's presence and not to recognize him in the midst of these battles. There's a second moment that I want to share with you where Jesus was emotionally vulnerable, and that's in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23. Before Matthew 23, as you turn there, Luke 19 tells us that Jesus was arriving to Jerusalem, overlooking the city, wept over it. Then, after Luke 19, Jesus starts walking towards the city of Jerusalem a little bit closer. And he tells his disciples, hey, go into town. Give me this little donkey that's never been ridden before. Bring it out to me. I'm going to ride into Jerusalem on this donkey. And so we know this triumphal moment where Jesus is going into Jerusalem and people are spreading their cloaks and these palm branches and this greenery on the road for Jesus. And they're shouting, Hosanna, Hosanna. They have that moment. Jesus goes into the temple, flips tables as any good king would do, walks out of the temple, walks out of Jerusalem, rests outside the city, and then this in Matthew 23 is day two. He goes back in to Jerusalem, goes immediately to the temple, and begins teaching. And so he has this long stint of teaching in Matthew 22 and Matthew 23. And we're going to read here, starting in verse 37, the end of seven, they're called seven woes that Jesus had against the Pharisees. And these woes are really warning signs like, hey, watch out for these people. You think that they are one way, but really they're a different way. Really, you see them as one way on the outside, but on the inside, I mean, as corrupt can be. These Pharisees and religious leaders who have been tracking Jesus's ministry, have been plotting a way to murder him, and their scheme is about to become successful. But before he is arrested, he's speaking in the temple, and he says this in verse 37. He turns his attention away from the Pharisees and again to the city of Jerusalem, and he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kill the prophets and stone those who sent you. Now, we believe Jesus to be much more than a prophet, but they were just about to do the same thing they have done now for centuries past. And he says, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. That's the saddest part right there, is I was longing to bring you in, but you were not willing. You weren't willing to come in. You weren't willing to receive more. You weren't willing to slow down and to connect and to see that I've been here all along. You weren't willing. And then in verse 38, he says, look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you that you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. These verses don't tell us that Jesus wept, but I think that we can hear the longing in his voice. We can tell that there's this sense of urgency that, yes, Christ is about to do what he was sent on earth to do, to experience a horrific death. That's where his life was leading to this moment. But I think more than that, what he was just beside himself about was that he'd been around these people for so long now, for years now. And just one moment after the other, they missed the presence of God in their life. And it's not God's fault. He longed to bring them underneath his shade. That's how one psalmist writes it, is I want to be under your shade, under your protection, in your refuge. I long to be in this intimate, close relationship with you. That's what Jesus desired for these people and even for us now. Now, I don't have kids, but I do have two nieces that mean a lot to me. And I treat them like they're my own. And this was a surprise to me. And what really concerns me is, again, these aren't my kids. These aren't my kids. But I had this reaction when they were born, because I was there shortly after their birth. Went to the hospital, got to see them. And it was definitely involuntary, because again, I didn't expect it. And it happened with the firstborn, whose name is Madeline, and it happened with the secondborn, whose name is Meredith. And what happened was, after getting a chance to hold them, getting this chance to look into their eyes and just to adore them for a second, I started crying. Like, not just like tearing up, but like ugly crying. I think my wife snapped this picture. This is Meredith there. But like, it was pitiful. It was so sad. It was so sad. Not the child. The child was beautiful. My state was sad. It took a while for me to recover. And this happened with Madeline, so I kind of expected it with Meredith, but I feel like it happened even worse with Meredith than it did with Madeline. And with Madeline, June was there, and I remember holding Madeline and turning to June, and her both and I go, ah! And let out this, I mean, we were in harmony with each other. It was a beautiful moment. And we just so happened to get that picture there. Wonderful. Go to the next slide. Wonderful. Thank you so much. But just by admiring them for a moment, it kind of opened my heart to this emotion, this joy, this adoration that I hadn't experienced since my wife came walking down the aisle, because there's also this picture, which I don't have and I'm not going to show you, of me bawling my eyes out when my wife is walking down the aisle. And so it was very similar to that. But it's just, you know, that's just one of those examples of one of those moments where you're holding someone that, and just like us in our relationship with Christ, like, there's nothing that we do to deserve that kind of love and attention and adoration. But it's just who we find out God is. That He admires me and He admires you. And I was writing that this week, I just felt like, you know, God was telling me that someone needs to hear today that God admires you. And just as we hold ones who are dear to us, He longs to bring us close and to hold us. And in fact, He is, yes, even in the midst of life's battles. That if you feel like, well, that just doesn't make sense to me because I've never done anything to deserve that kind of adoration, none of us have. But He longs for all of us to be brought in close, and for us to be, as He gives us this picture of under His wing. But I think there is a problem, I think, that we need to identify before we can address how are we going to slow down to pay attention and to connect to this type of love that Jesus has for His people. I think that we have to address this problem of activity and this problem of doing. This graph here shows you an improper balance to being with God, being in a, we'll talk about it in a second, in a contemplative place with God. You see that word, contemplation. You see that there's an improper balance when we find ourselves doing things for God and our life flows from activity of doing rather than our life flowing from being, or at least these two circles being the same size. So in Western Christianity and American Christianity, when someone becomes a Christian, let's think through this process. We Americans do what Americans do best. We get people busy. That's what we do. We start doing stuff. That's what we start doing, right? Maybe after you become a Christian, you start attending a worship service once a week. You beat the statistics and you come once every single week. Congratulations. We appreciate you guys. And you come to worship as you are now. Maybe during the week, you get busy doing devotionals and spending 5 or 10 minutes in the morning or in the afternoon with Jesus. Maybe you participate in a small group. Here we call them life groups, but you get involved in a life group. Maybe you begin to trust God with your finances, and yes, He even begins to affect you in that area of your life. And so you begin to trust Him, and you end up giving to His work. Maybe you begin to evangelize to people and you begin to witness to them and you tell them of this love and adoration that we're talking about today that Christ has for us. You attend retreats, you go to conferences, you read books, you listen to podcasts. And let me just say before I go any further that all of that stuff is wonderful. Continue to do those things, All right? Not saying you should stop doing those things. Those are all wonderful things, things that even myself, things that I do, wonderful ways to grow. But my question is, how can Christians be involved and immersed in the world of activity and church and be busy doing things for God but still feel stuck? That there may be some areas of our life that the light of Christ touches and transforms, but as we know, and this is not a Cornerstone problem, we see this across the church, capital C, that people live their Christian life and some places in their life remain stuck, whether it's an addiction, whether it's with pride or with anger or with bitterness, or even, dare we say, spiritual tiredness, right? And we feel stuck in certain areas in our life and we go, but I'm doing all the right things. So what's the problem? What do I need in my life? And we're more concerned with doing for Christ than we are. We find ourselves spending less and less and less time just simply being with him and beholding him. So let me introduce to you a category of spiritual practices, which a lot of people call them spiritual disciplines. I like to call them spiritual practices. You know what spiritual practices are. It's like reading your Bible, praying. There are some that we don't talk about a whole lot. One of those we're going to talk about today. But I like to call them spiritual practices because with anything, the more we do it, the better we get at it. And it's been taught to me as disciplines, which really made me feel as if when I was failing the first time at it, it's just something I shouldn't try again, right? Because you need to be disciplined in this. But I refer to them as spiritual practices, and that's what I mean. But there's this branch of spiritual practices called contemplative practices. And if you've never heard of that, I want to make it digestible for us. Contemplative, when you hear that word, you may think of the word contemplation. And congratulations, it's the same exact word, just with a different ending. Contemplation, you know what contemplation is. We all do contemplation well. It's when we dwell on something or when we have these prolonged thoughts of something. We all contemplate, every single one of us, we contemplate big decisions, financial moves, job changes, having children, moving houses. We contemplate big decisions in life, but we also contemplate small decisions. Does this dress look good on me? Should I get coffee this morning? We contemplate and we dwell on different decisions throughout our day. And so this is not something, dwelling on something is not something that has to be taught. It's just something we find ourselves all naturally good at. Let me tell you what the word contemplation comes from. The word contemplation comes from this Greek word theoria. And this word has several different meanings. In the Eastern Christianity tradition, in other words, Christians across the pond, they find themselves on the other side of the Atlantic and on the other side of the Pacific. They find themselves doing these contemplative practices that we never talk about in Western Christianity or in America. And they define contemplation as to see God, or, when I read this, I almost had a Pentecostal moment in my office, to see God or to receive the vision of God is what I read. So by contemplating, by being with God, what we receive is his vision. Which if you're like me, you're like, yes, that's what I want. I want his vision. I want to behold him. I want to be in union with him. I want to see God and I want to see what God sees. Who doesn't want that? Right? If you're following Jesus, you're like, yes, I want your outlook. I admire Paul's outlook, who had the outlook of Christ, because while he was in jail, he said to churches he was writing to, he said, don't pray that I get out. He said, pray that I have the chance to witness the gospel to people while I'm in jail. That's the kind of outlook we want. That's the kind of vision that we want. That we see people the way that God sees them, that we have this outlook that Christ has. That my prayers and my worship and my life would all flow from this vision of God. And right now you may be thinking, Chris, you've convinced me. That's what I want. We're going to get there together. Let's go to Luke chapter 10 to figure out how we get there. We're going to see through this how we slow down, how we can pay attention, and how we can connect to God's love. Through a familiar passage in Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 38, you've probably read it before or you've heard it read several times. And it says, as Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. So Jesus and his disciples come unannounced. It's not like they sent, we don't get the picture that they sent a messenger ahead. They could have, but according to Martha's reaction, we don't really get that image of that. We don't know for sure, but they come unannounced. And as you would now as an American, and you would even more so than as a first century Jew, Martha begins running around. But we see that Mary, as we're introduced to in verse 39, sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. And then in verse 40 it says, but Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. And so she came to Jesus and she said, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Preparing a meal for so many people in my house that just showed up unannounced. Don't you care? Sounds like us in our battles. Don't you care? And then I can imagine Jesus in a calm voice saying, Martha, Martha, look at what her emotions are. You are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Martha's problem goes beyond just her busyness. She is living life right now in this moment, uncentered and divided. And we have this contrast of Mary, and we see that the gravity in Mary's life right now, what's holding her world center, what's holding her in place, what she is grounded in, is hearing the voice of her King. That's what she did. She decided that yes, there are a million things to do right now, but what's going to hold my world center is the voice of Jesus himself. She was able to, in this moment, to slow down, to pay attention, and she was able to connect. Martha, living life undivided and uncentered, was not able to connect to Jesus, but Mary was. Corrie ten Boom once said this, that if the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. And the reason why he'll make you busy is because if he makes you busy, then he keeps you out of the presence of Jesus. If he makes you busy, then yes, you may be thinking it's the ultimate trick. You may be thinking to yourself, yes, there's a lot that I do for Christ. Look at these things. Look at my resume. Look at my heavenly script I'm going to pull out and show to Jesus when I get up there to those pearly gates. But all the while, we find ourselves uncentered and divided, not being held by our unity and by listening to Jesus's voice, simply being with him, dwelling on him, and beholding him. And I love how at the end of this, Jesus even corrects himself. He says, Mary has, you're upset about many things, only few things are needed. And then he says, or actually, indeed, only one thing is needed in this life, and Mary had found it. And that one thing that was true of her then is true of us now, and it's the need to be connected to the King. How can we remain emotionally healthy and spiritually alive in the midst of life's battles? I want to talk to you for a little bit, for the time we have left, about the practice of solitude. As I said earlier, this is something that we see Jesus did. And if we're going to become like Jesus, we have to do what Jesus did. And so we see that Jesus, before great times of ministry, before a great season of busyness, he would go off to be alone, to slow down, to pay attention, and to connect to the love of his Father. We would also see that after, we talked about this at the men's conference in a small group, that after great times of ministry, like after he stayed up all night healing people and it was late into the evening and he was tired and he came in and he slept, he wouldn't just the next day as we would sleep in, but he wakes up early and he goes to be alone with his father, to slow down and to connect. Now, solitude, here's the thing about solitude. It is vastly simple, but extremely difficult at the same time, is what I've found as I've been practicing this practice. It's simple because solitude is simply you on your own, by yourself. Leave your phone wherever it needs to be laid, leave it, and go to be by you, by yourself, and to be with God, and to spend time being with him. And we'll talk practically about what this looks like. But it's also vastly difficult because you will find that your mind is kind of getting off kilter. You're trying to do your best to dwell and to behold and to receive this vision of God when you first begin this practice of solitude. Maybe you start off by saying a short prayer and then you spend time just listening and thinking about him. I find that a great place to do this is out in nature, but then you become distracted by nature itself and you find yourself becoming distracted by things you know you have to do that day. Thoughts enter your mind of things that have happened weeks, maybe months ago. One time I was sitting in solitude, and yes, it looked just like that picture I showed you earlier. I started crying. And I was like, why am I crying right now? Like, nothing bad had happened recently, you know? Things were okay, you know, not great, but they're like, yeah, it's all right, you know? Why am I crying right now? And I found myself in this confused place of trying to be with God, but at the same time, I was impacted by these emotions that came up that I didn't expect, and these thoughts that I thought were dealt with, they had been put behind me, were immediately rushing to the frontal cortex of my brain. And I was like, why won't you get out of my head? I'm trying to think about Jesus right now. And you feel like a failure. And you begin to think to yourself, well, maybe there's no hope for me. Maybe I should revert back to what I used to do. I used to just take my phone and have a devotional, and then notifications would pop up on my phone. You know, I'm in the Bible app, and then I would become distracted, and my life with God became very disconnected, that my being with him became disconnected. And as I said, when I approached at first this practice of solitude, I began to think to myself, okay, I am failing really miserable at this. And as I began to investigate it more and to hear testimonies from people who also would go out, leave their phone, not be with anyone else, just be with them and God, I heard a lot of the same stories. And I was like, oh, I'm not alone in this. Everyone else is a failure too. It's not just me. And as you break yourself away from the world, what you'll see is that you cannot just leave it behind because it comes with you. And what changed was I stopped shaming myself. And when my mind became distracted, I would just get it back on track instead of saying, well, this is a waste of time. When I found emotions coming up that clearly I had tucked away and not dealt with, rather than, you know, wiping my eyes and wiping my nose and saying, suck it up, Chris, I would talk with them about, I would talk them out and talk with them about Jesus and ask questions about them and tell him if I felt broken, how I felt broken, if I felt lost, how I feel lost. And it became this time where it wasn't just about, it's not just about doing one thing after another, but it's just about being, and it's about being with him. And that's what this practice does. It makes us slow down, pay attention, and to connect to his love. And I realize, as someone who doesn't have kids in my house, that this is a lot easier for me to do. And thankfully, sacrifice is not something that we're unfamiliar with as Christians, right? That we find that as we follow Jesus, there are life changes. There are sacrifices that we make. For some parents, if you decide, I'm going to nudge my life in this direction, I'm no longer going to allow the devil to keep me focused on my battles and to keep it focused on my busyness. Instead, I'm going to nudge myself towards in different ways in my life, maybe starting with solitude, that I'm going to nudge myself in that direction of both being with God and receiving His vision and not giving up on this process. Yes, it may even take sacrificing some schedule time of, you know, parents, whether it's flip-flopping and having that time, whether it's doing after they go to bed, or yes, even waking up earlier. What I've found is even for myself, who doesn't have kids in the house all the time, there are things that would go undone. There are things that go undone. And I'm just learning that those things may be important, but it's not the most important. There's only one thing in your life and in my life that is needed, and that is connection to the King. That's it. I want to leave you with this. Jesus said in Matthew 11:28, He said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me." I love that. "And learn from me. And I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy and my burden is light." If you find yourself today feeling burdened and heavy and uneasy and not at rest, what your life requires is not more distraction. It requires more being with your Father in heaven, who loves you and does not want you to live your life in the midst of these battles distracted and burdened by our absence in His presence. Because His presence is always with us, but we can choose whether or not we're going to enter that place and find rest and solace with Him.